One of the most fundamental principles God put into his creation is that of cause and effect. You know, I've often wondered at times, and many of us have, well, why do weeds grow where they grow? Well, they grow when the land becomes barren to fill in the empty space, frankly. And places we've lived, as I've asked some of the older people in the area whose, in some cases, their parents maybe settled and homesteaded those properties, and they would talk about what the land was like when they moved in and what the land looks like now. And in New Mexico, the cactus literally moved in after the grass was grazed off in many of the areas. Now, I'm not saying that accounts for all cactus, but in some of the land areas where we had members on property, literally it was basically grassland when it was homesteaded. And now there's cactus in there because of the destruction of the soil and the grazing grass that was in place. God put into creation cause and effect. Everything happens for a reason. I don't mean by that that everything is fated, but I mean cause and effect. Everything happens for a reason. It's cause and effect that keeps us from running out in the street without looking, because we know that if we make certain choices, other things will happen as a result. It's cause and effect that makes us careful when we're driving down the street. As we're coming down the side of the canyon hill here on the highway today, pulling up behind a tractor trailer, cars passing me on the left side, having to just make sure you're careful, stay off the back of the trailer, wait till I can clear and pass on the left. You're watching very, very carefully because the stakes are very high. Cause and effect impacts everything that we say and do. There's also a spiritual application to cause and effect in the way God established it in the creation, and that's in Galatians 6 and verse number 7. This is cause and effect with a spiritual application. Do not be deceived. God is not mocked. Now, when it says God is not mocked, what it means is not just that God has no interest. It means that God is invested and that you're not going to cross him. You're not going to turn against what he created. You're not going to ignore him without some kind of a result taking place. So don't be deceived. Don't kid yourself. God isn't mocked. And then it says something that you would almost separate from relationship to God. Whatever a man sows, that he will also reap. So it says, God isn't mocked because whatever you do is going to have a result. The fact is, God put that into his creation. All of us reap the fruit of our thoughts and our actions. And it's the way God intended. In fact, it's where God has invested in that way part of his own focus. Some years back in the church, there was a sermon giving, "You Reap What You Sow." And out of that sermon, which went to the churches, there was an article written in the Good News, and I have pondered that many, many times because it is so fundamental that everything that I do is going to create some effect or have some result. My thoughts, my words, my actions, the steps you take, the course you set has a result and an impact on our life, on our friends and family life, and frankly, at times, even on the church as a whole. The problem is, though, that we begin to doubt if that is really true. We know it's true in the end, that in the end, everyone will receive final judgment. But in the process of getting there, we begin to wonder, because of the way life plays out around us, if that is really true. There seems to be a lot of exceptions to you reap what you sow. Timothy McVeigh, did you hear about his execution? Well, there wasn't an execution. Now, there hasn't been anybody that's been put up for the death penalty that in the eyes of most Americans probably is more deserving of being executed than Timothy McVeigh. In fact, even when they take a poll and they say only 60% of the people believe in the death penalty, 80% believe it should be applied to Timothy McVeigh. So even people that don't believe in the death penalty think they ought to get him. So, I mean, there's no question on that in terms of how that played out. He admitted he did it, He's not sorry that he did it. He said he would do it again. Now, what is there left that we have to discuss? But the FBI didn't turn over some of the documents to the defense. The defense is claiming that they have been defrauded in some way from having a proper trial. And now even one of Timothy McVeigh's lawyers said that he might even contest his execution. Personally, I don't believe it. I think that's posture. But the fact is, it almost seems like it never really happened. Punishment was not met out. And somehow, at least for another month, he got away. He has yet to really reap what he sowed. Now, we see this play out in different ways. Any of you heard the name Ronnie Biggs? Does Ronnie Biggs come to mind? If you live in Britain, you'd probably be incredibly familiar. Sean Connery played Ronnie Biggs in the movie The Great Train Robbery. Ronnie Biggs had a group of friends that went out and robbed a train in England back in 1963, and it was the largest robbery that had ever taken place like that up to its time. 2.5 million English pounds back in 1963, equivalent of approximately $50 million today. They walked with the cash, and they got it out of there, and then most of them at a later point were captured. But Ronnie Biggs escaped from prison, and he escaped with his share of the loot. And so he spent his life in, I forget, South America somewhere, wine, women, and song, a few plastic surgeries, plenty of money to go around. He was captured again, but he had to be released because the country where he was captured had no extradition treaty with Britain. And so he was set free again. He lived his whole life on the lam, free to spend his money, wine, women, song, lived high, threw it around, and enjoyed himself as best you could doing such things. And now at the end of his life, he's broke and he's sick and he wants to go home to England. He said he wants to sit in a pub and have a beer as a free man before he dies. One of the reports I read said that he was broke and he wanted to return to England so that he could have free medical care for his remaining days. I thought, that's amazing. Here's a man who took what we would look at today as $50 million from people of that day, out of their accounts, out of their savings, out of their livelihood, lived it on, lived it up, threw it around, spent it and wasted it, spent his whole life now to very near the end, and returns home so that he can get free medical care for the last of his days. There seem to be exceptions to you reap what you sow. Now, I said, we don't question the end. We know judgment is in the end, but we question in between sometimes. The diplomats come to the United States from other countries, and they have tickets, and they have violations of various kinds, and they simply pile up and ignore them because you can't arrest them, and they don't have to pay them. And we go, well, they're not having to reap what they sow. If you play baseball, in professional ball, a fast pitch is about 95 miles an hour. Now, you can go faster than that, but let's just say a fast pitch is 95 miles an hour. From the time it leaves the pitcher's hand until it crosses home plate is about 0.4 seconds. The batter has 0.5 seconds to decide if he is going to swing. The bat that he swings actually covers its cross to the ball in 0.2 seconds. Everything is happening very, very fast. If his swing is 0.1 second early or 0.1 second late, you know what happens to the ball? It goes foul. 0.1 second, either side, and the ball goes left or it goes right. Now, you have to hit it perfect almost for it to work. You know what? It doesn't matter if you agree with that. It doesn't matter if you don't think that's fair. It doesn't matter if you resent it and wish it wasn't so, because that's just the way it is. That's the law of baseball, and that's the way it's played. Now, it doesn't matter in life if you feel that somehow life's been unfair to you, or if life has not served you justly, or if your opportunities haven't been what you desired or wished. You reap what you sow, and that's just the way it is. By creation, the choices that we make impact our life. The choices we refuse to make, fail to make, don't think about making, wished we had made, all still impact our lives. Now, Satan doesn't want us really to believe that. He doesn't want us to believe that we reap what we sow. He doesn't want us to believe that everything we do is going to have some effect, positive or negative. And he wants us to think that we can do some things, and frankly, there'll be no effect at all, or instead of a problem being created, actually a blessing is generated as a result. That's what Satan would have us to believe. That's what he told Adam and Eve. Look at Genesis 3. Scripture is familiar to us. In fact, I just used a portion of this a few months back. But Genesis 3, Satan wants us to believe that cause and effect is not really what it is, the way God created it, and that you don't really reap what you sow. That you can get away with murder, as it is stated. The serpent was more cunning than any beast of the field which the Lord God had made, and he said to the woman, "Has God indeed said, you shall not eat of every tree of the garden?" The woman said to the serpent, "We may eat of the fruit of the trees in the garden, but of the fruit of the tree in the midst of the garden, God has said, you shall not eat of it, you shall not touch it, lest you die." Cause and effect, reap sow. If you do this, God says, here's the end result. Here's what's going to happen. Satan comes through and says, "Nah, come on. If you swing off by 100th of a second, you're telling me that you can't play this game? That they won't let you run around the bases? How ridiculous can you get? 100th of a second, and you can't run the bases?" That's right. In professional ball. Now, we came by little towns as we drove down here, and they got little league games going and all kinds of other things, and the rules are a little different for that. But not in pro ball. And the serpent said to the woman, "You will not surely die. For God knows in the day you eat of it, your eyes will be opened and you'll be like God, knowing good and evil." So when the woman saw the tree was good for food, pleasant to the eyes, tree desirable to make one wise, she took of its fruit and ate, and she gave to her husband with her, and he ate, and they took on themselves the penalty of death. They sinned. They turned and rebelled against God. God said, if you do that, this will happen. Satan said, don't worry about it. It's not that bad. In fact, you're probably going to enjoy it. Wait till you taste it. Wait till you see it. Wait till you experience the knowledge and the wisdom of making your own choices. You see, this impacts us so much because Satan's world, his system, teaches us that there are exceptions to this rule of creation, the rule that God made. Now, the kind of exceptions that do exist are the ones that God himself institutes. When God gives us and grants us mercy at times, that is indeed an exception, a miraculous exception. There are times when God intervenes and actually removes the consequence of our bad choice. I've known God in circumstances miraculously to have intervened and saved someone from an auto accident, stopped the car from going off the road, interceded in some cases, and healed an individual, obviously, in various ways from the consequences of one circumstance or another. And so God has such power as that. We are his people. We are his family. God loves us, but he does not exempt us from cause and effect. God doesn't exempt even those he loves in a very great way from cause and effect. He put that in creation for a purpose. Abraham is one of the major people that God has worked with in history, one of the big examples in the Bible. We know from the record that he's going to be in the kingdom of God. He's one of our Bible heroes. You know, if anybody obtained mercy and had opportunity to receive mercy from God, I would say Abraham would surely qualify. But Abraham didn't get a pass on the consequences of all of his choices. God has intervened selectively in very merciful ways, and he still does. But he does not take us out of the consequences of living in the midst of this world and of his creation. Genesis 16. Sarai, Abraham's wife, had borne him no children. She had an Egyptian maidservant whose name was Hagar. And Sarai said to Abram, "See now, the Lord has restrained me from bearing children. Please go into my maid. Perhaps I shall obtain children by her." And Abram heeded the voice of Sarai. Not heeded the voice of God, heeded the voice of Sarai, called later Sarah. Then Sarai, Abram's wife, took Hagar, her maid, the Egyptian, gave her to her husband Abram to be his wife after Abram had dwelt in 10 years in the land of Canaan. So he went into Hagar, and she conceived, and when she saw that she had conceived, her mistress became despised in her eyes. Sarai said to Abram, "My wrong be upon you. I gave my maid to your embrace, and when she saw that she had conceived, I became despised in her eyes." What did you think? What did Abraham think when he put the two women in the one house and made that decision and tried to raise the children and have the competition and the jealousies and the rivalries? Why did God say to leave your father and mother and go get your own place and have some peace? That's a paraphrase, obviously, but there's two sets of minds there. Even where there's comparable values, there's two sets of philosophies, and there's schedules, and there's habits and custom and things that require a measure then of separation for peace. Abraham here was not exempted. You say, oh, but God needed all these children so that he could have all these nations, so that he could have all these people to inherit the promise, and yet Abraham made a decision based on his wife's request that you had to know was not smart. And do you think he had contention in his household from that time on? Did it buy him peace? He bought himself a peck of trouble. And it was a decision he made, and it was the consequences that came from the choice. God did not exempt him from that, even though he was blessing him as the father of the faithful, our example, bringing fruit out of his loins for the children of Israel, working with Abraham in a way that we won't even ever hardly understand. He was working with him in such a great way, making covenant with him, which is the significant covenant of this part of the Bible record, and yet he still didn't exempt him from the consequences of the choices that he made. When God says he will not be mocked, that we reap what we sow, he means just exactly that. He has put that in place for a reason. God is merciful to us. He wants to forgive us. He wants us to have faith in him, but he does not give us a pass on our choices. Some of the seeds that we plant take an incredibly long time to germinate. I read one account. I was in Montana this past week, and one of the places I stopped, they served me dinner, and we had turkey, and it was delicious. And they said, well, you know, we haven't been eating much beef lately because of mad cow disease. And I said, you know, I don't know if people would even notice if I had the disease. It probably wouldn't even show up. But I said, one of the articles I read on mad cow disease was that it can incubate up to 30 years, possibly. Up to 30 years, possibly, before it becomes obvious or evident. Now, I don't care. You got to go somehow. That would be a terrible way, but I don't know that I have control over worrying about such things. But some of the seeds that we plant, you know, mad cow, you know where they're saying it came from? It came from having animals eat other animals. Because you could save a buck on the feed and process this waste animal product and bring it in and mix it with your feed and feed it to your animals. And so you had now a transmission. Now, how much sense does it take to not feed one animal to another animal? How much do you have to think about that? But when somebody gets greedy for a very small amount of money, they actually risk destroying themselves and the rest of us as well. You reap what you sow. And we are not exempt from that. If a farmer plants his seeds one day and then goes out the next day and nothing came up, does that mean he had a crop failure? Or does that mean it just simply takes longer than that for the seeds to germinate and the crop to produce? Sometimes in our lives, we've done some reckless and horrible things, and I have certainly done my share and a few others. And because at that moment in time, we look back and nothing yet has taken place, does that mean that there's no crop on its way? Doesn't mean that at all. Ecclesiastes 8. God put us in an environment that is responsive to our choices in dramatic ways and sometimes long-lasting ways for our benefit to learn the lesson that we need to know that our choices are important. We cannot just simply close our eyes and point the dart in the, toward the board and expect to hit the mark. We have to consciously choose to follow and to obey God. Ecclesiastes 8:11. Because the sentence against evil work is not executed speedily, and here's the problem. Because the crop that we planted has not come in yet, we are sometimes deceived into thinking that it wasn't bad seed, even though the crop that is in production and on its way is full of weeds and thorns. But because it hasn't quite yet come to fruition, we think maybe it's okay after all, that that wasn't such a bad deal. It's not true. And God will not be mocked. Because sentence against an evil work is not executed speedily, therefore the heart of the sons of men is fully set in them to do evil. Though a sinner does evil 100 times and his days are prolonged, yet I surely know that it will be well with those who fear God, who fear before him. I don't care, God says, how good it looks for the person who is evil, who has sowed his seed and does not seem to have had to pay his dues, I surely tell you, I will not be mocked. He will sow what he will reap what he has sown. But it will not be well with the wicked, nor will he prolong his days, which are as a shadow, because he does not fear before God. Life is a little bit like throwing a boomerang, and some of the boomerangs will come back real soon. And if you throw real hard and well, some of them will circle out there a little longer before they return back. Life's a little bit like that. Some issues in regard to sickness, family problems, financial problems, emotional problems, elements of all of those things are seed that we have sown. And some of it is bearing fruit now, some of it is on its way, some of it is past. But it's cause and effect. Now there's financial blessings and emotional blessings and family blessings as well, because if you use good seed and make good choice and sow that and nourish that and feed that according to God's word, then you also have the same choice. You can drive down this hill and wreck your car. You can drive down this hill safely and have a blessing at the bottom because you've arrived at your destination. We have that choice. I'm not saying we have total, absolute control. I am saying all of our choices have effects. All of our seed raises a crop of one kind of fruit or another. My son, Brad, I have mentioned in sermons in past, I wasn't there as he was raised. I walked out the door. And I didn't meet him until he graduated from high school, and his nature at that time was very kindly, and we were able to take him as our family and our son and have relationship with him for quite a number of years. And it was a joy to the family, and we thought as well it was a joy to him. And I thought, this is incredible. I sowed bad seed. I was illicit in my actions. I was not responsible in following through. I wasn't there to raise him. I didn't pay that price as I should have. And yet, and then I repented and God forgave me. And not only that, the social consequences of my actions, not in every single element, but in the worst way, have been dissolved. And so I just thank God for his grace and mercy in that way, because over those years I had prayed that something proper would happen, that God would protect and bless who was out there, because I hadn't checked. And it seemed to work pretty well, and then there was an issue that became a bit of a stumbling block for my son, and he disengaged from our family, and I haven't seen or talked to him or heard from him now for 2 years. And I think about that now, looking back, and I says, you know, I sowed the seed, and it looked to me like the crop had failed to arrive and come up. And I was happy for the blessings that we had in those years, and I pray for the blessings that will one day hopefully return. But the fact is, there was a crop that was still growing that I had not, frankly, been able to see. And now we pray for his protection and blessing where he is, and his safe and soon return. God could have stopped that. God could have fixed that. God could have made that work. God let me, and by extension, my family, who loves him and cared for him as I do, but God let that action take place. And I know where it came from, and I know how it began. And the only way to have avoided it completely was not to have done that in the first place. Not to have sowed the seed in the beginning. There was no other guaranteed solution. We can't believe the impact sometimes of choices that we make, not just on ourselves. We impact each other. An article from some years back I kept that mentioned PCBs used in electrical transformers and other things in industry, talking about how long-lived the PCB is in the environment once it's been released. For children born into the 22nd century, 22nd century is what's being referred to, the adage, you are what you eat, may need to be rewritten to read, you are what your great-great-great-grandmother ate. PCB contamination of people who eat tainted food is a problem that can span 6 generations. Can you imagine doing something that would affect your grandchildren for 6 generations passed on through your lineage? A researcher told a House Public Works and Transportation Committee Thursday, a 20-year-old woman giving birth to a child passes on sufficient PCBs so that even if all exposure to the substance stopped, I would still measure PCB in the body fat 6 generations in the future. Scientist making presentation to the committee. Swain's figure suggests that at 30 years to a generation, children born in the year 2138 would still suffer contamination from PCBs ingested in 1988 and inherited through the female line. Can you imagine making a choice? You say, I didn't make a choice. Somebody else made the choice. Cause and effect, seed and fruit from seed is all around us. And we do it in ways that maybe we sometimes don't measure at all. And we're subject to ways that others don't measure at all. PCB production has been banned for years, but the substance, believed to cause cancer, continues to enter the environment through such sources as old electric transformers. Infants exposed to excessive PCB levels tend to be shorter, have smaller heads, are more likely to catch infectious diseases, and exhibit an inability to focus on their surroundings. And you can say crack babies, you can say something else, you can say something else. It is unbelievable. Guy Muller, I was with him this week, and he's mentioned to me recently, Guy used to raise wheat when he had a farm and a ranch there. He raised wheat on part of it. And he would harvest the wheat and he would take it into the mill, and the mill had a test kitchen. And this is years ago now, and the test kitchen would take his wheat and make it into angel food cake, or a angel. They'd make a few to test it for the quality of the wheat. And then they'd present him with the angel food cake. And so every year he'd take his wheat in, they'd bake him this big fluffy cake, and they'd hand it to him as a present. And he got used to that. And one year he went in with his wheat, and they never brought him a cake. And he thought that was strange. And after a while he kind of felt like, you know, what's the deal? I mean, this was a nice little token of my product. And so he went and he asked him about it. And the man at the mill, when he confronted him on the cake, said, you've started fertilizing, haven't you? And Guy said, well, yes. He started using nitrogen fertilizer that year for the first time. And the man says, well, your wheat won't make the cake on its own anymore. Now, what's wrong with fertilizer? Well, what's wrong with nitrogen fertilizer? Well, I don't know. I'm not a farmer. But he literally was told by somebody who had not asked him that, by the way the product now performed, he knew that there had been a chemical change take place. Now, I don't know what they do to make angel food cakes today, or how big they fluff them up and with what, and blow a bunch of air into them, or however they make that work. But it's an amazing story, because even that little change made a chemical change that was evident to the mill when he took the product in. Our current increase is not the bottom line. How satisfying a particular action is to us, or how fruitful it would appear to be, is not the bottom line. Every action causes an effect. Every choice. God built it into the creation, and we are subject to that, and God has not chosen to remove us from that. And when he applies that in a spiritual sense, what you sow, you will reap, and those around us. Because some of the seed takes so long to come to fruition, we begin to believe that the crop really isn't imminent after all. That kind of an option is not truly going to take place. Just because we didn't get an education doesn't really mean we won't have a good job. Just because we're in a field that doesn't have any work left doesn't mean that it won't work out anyway some other way. Just because we didn't train, just because we didn't withhold ourselves sexually, just because we drank too much, just because we tried drugs, doesn't mean that everything's going to go to seed on us. It doesn't? Well, the risks are very, very high. There will be a crop. I wonder what the effect of my heavy drinking in the army has been on my third or fourth generation of children. I wonder. I wonder just exactly what the effect has been on me. I drank in the army at one point to the point where when I got up in the morning, I had the shakes. And I had to go sweat out the poison enough to stabilize by noon so that I could go out that evening and go drinking again. I look back at that and I can't undo that. I can say, well, look at him. He's still speaking. He can still think part of the time. I wonder, there is a crop that has come to fruition on that I may never be able to quantify. It's like that Good News Magazine promotion that went out. It was folded a little funny, and the cover was shrunk 7%, and the card wasn't perforated, but it was still a Good News promotion. And somebody can still cut it out and send it in and get the good news. And I've heard of magazines being pulled out of trash cans, found on the street, blown by, cards falling out of things and people picking them up. I know all those things happen, but there's no way to know ever what it could possibly have been. How do we know that illnesses we have aren't generated because of fault, failure, disease, exposure, diet, lack of exercise, lack of mental focus, lack of spiritual focus? You see, we don't go back. God just tells us, I won't be mocked. Every single thing has an effect. Every single thing has a result. And you know it, and don't think that I'm going to exempt you from all of that. That's the world you're in. It's pretty important that you take stock of that and as early as you can make the choices that obey me and serve my purpose. You're going to have to believe me in that, God says, because the world's going to tell you there's exceptions and you don't have to worry about that and it won't really happen. It just won't really happen. Psalm 10. Did I ever read Psalm 10? See right there. There's the effect of it right there. So sometimes, because evil appears to prosper, that we can tend to think that really it's okay. Look, they're getting away with it. How many times, if everybody around us is speeding, would we say, well, you know, I'll speed? Boy, I came over the hill on the way down here this morning, and right there was a policeman, and the speed limit was 60, and I think I was at 61. And I still was waiting for him to pull me over. And I watch him in my rear view as I go down the other side, and I'm going, man, am I glad. I mean, cars had passed me coming down, and, you know, you're really tempted to say, well, you know, let's go. Let's get out of here. I'll get down there and get to church. And as sure as I would have done that, he'd have got me. And you didn't know that because the last 20 times there was nobody there. And it looked just fine. Psalm 10. The psalmist here, in this sense, is kind of crying out to God, how come all these other people are speeding by, but I'm the one that approaches the policeman as I crest the hill? Why is this going on? It looks like these people are really getting away with unbelievable things. Why do you stand afar off, O Lord? Why do you hide yourself in times of trouble? The wicked in his pride persecutes the poor. Let them be caught in the plots which they have devised. For the wicked boasts in his heart's desire. He blesses the greedy. He renounces the Lord. The wicked in his proud countenance does not seek God. God is in none of his thoughts. And yet his ways are always prospering. Your judgments are far above, out of his sight. As for his enemies, all his enemies, he sneers at them. He said in his heart, I shall not be moved. I shall never be in adversity. His mouth is full of cursing and deceit and oppression, and under his tongue is trouble and iniquity. He sits in the lurking places of the villages, in the secret places he murders the innocent. His eyes are secretly fixed on the helpless. He lies in wait secretly as a lion in his den. He lies in wait to catch the poor. He catches the poor when he draws him into his net. He crouches, lies low, so that the helpless may fall by his strength. He has said in his heart, God is forgotten. He hides his face. He'll never see it. He said in his heart, I'll do what I want. I can get away with it. There is no problem at all. Do you know how I would describe that? I would describe that like jumping out of an airplane without a parachute. That would be so much fun. Roaring back and forth, you know, you put your arms out and you can travel in different directions and it would be so much fun, but for a moment, because the end is absolutely guaranteed. It will happen. And frankly, if we could look back at all these wonderful people's lives that this world idolizes, like the movie stars that are constantly giving their political impressions and putting their face on all the magazine covers with the big smiley expression, if we could look at the ride from the inside, I think it would look much different than the ride from the outside. Why is it every time I go in the supermarket, the cover on the tabloid of the magazine has some smiling, beautiful actress who is in the process of I have my life together now? How come every week I go in, she just now got her life together again? She just got over divorce, just got off alcohol or drug abuse, just got out of something else, turned around and got her health back. I mean, it's the story is always on top of the world again. Well, that's all they report about, because the whole rest of the time seems to be full of confusion and trauma and betrayal and corruption and vanity. I don't think the ride, frankly, is even that good. I don't think it's even that good. But what happens is it puts us at risk. In Psalm 73, it describes the fact that when we see this sanitized appearance of evil having a good time, that it makes us wonder if indeed they're really going to reap what they sow. And it makes us question if that law really is in place. It's truly God is good to Israel, Psalm 73, to such as are pure of heart. And then notice this, but as for me, my feet had almost stumbled, my steps had nearly slipped, for I was envious of the boastful when I saw the prosperity of the wicked. Now, it goes through and it describes in a much fuller way what the context of that is. But it says, when I saw the prosperity of the wicked, I was envious and it almost tripped me up. When I saw somebody who'd been abusive doing quite well, I almost slipped and got angry with you, God, because it seemed like my crop had come in and theirs hadn't. And we have to watch that. God said by his own creation, you will reap what you sow. The only way out of that spiritually is through the sacrifice of Jesus Christ, where we are forgiven of our sins. And even in our healing, the sacrifice of Christ, the stripes that he took to himself, is applied to that as well. But apart from submitting ourselves to God, there is no separation from that rule. And even physically, God chooses not necessarily to remove us from that process. Why? So that we will learn to choose. The quickest way to learn to choose is just to put your hand on a hot pot and you'll never grab the hot pot again. God put creation around us in a way that would react to our choices, and the consequences would be clear. We would like sometimes to think that our good intentions ought to count for something, at least if we're trying, okay? If we really meant well, then we would like that to have some kind of a weight on the ledger. He had a good heart. All right, the farmer goes out to plant, and he plants wheat. And he wanted to plant wheat. And he told the neighbors that he wanted to plant wheat, and he wanted that big angel food cake out there that they would make for him at the mill, and he was excited about his wheat, but you see, he was in a rush when he grabbed the seed, and he actually grabbed the oats and scattered that instead. Now, will the good intentions of the farmer change the crop? Obviously not. But we want the good intentions of our hearts to change the crop of the decisions that we make. And God doesn't say that is going to be true. I think if we live by our conscience, then God can work with us and we'll obey God accordingly. But that doesn't reverse the crop that is then produced by the choices that we have made. Our heart must be right, but our actions must be right as well. Matthew 7 describes verse 21, context here. There are people who are going to strive in their minds to do that which they think is right, or they're going to try to plant the seed that they personally value, and God is going to say, I'm sorry, that's not what I said to do. Not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, shall enter into the kingdom of heaven, but he who does the will of my Father in heaven. Not the religious person who keeps Christmas in its rightful sense, as Christians see Christmas in the sense of, well, we keep it to the Lord. But the one who actually does what God said to do. Not just the nice person who chooses for himself what is right and what is wrong. Many will say to me in that day, Lord, Lord, have we not prophesied in your name, cast out demons in your name, done many wonders in your name? And I will declare to them, I never knew you. Depart from me, you who practice lawlessness. Those things that are against the law of God is lawlessness. Those people who practice those things with all of the best intentions still have not responded to God. Now we know in calling God opens the mind, and a person who is sincere would sincerely respond to God, we would think, and that is our expectation. But the fact is, all of our good intentions, I can't use it in my sermon, but there's a particular road that is paved to a particular place that is paved with good intentions, right? At least that's what they say. Unfortunately, again, we live in a society where consequences are unacceptable. And so we then can be impacted by that and begin to think that the crop's not going to come in. We must not be accountable for our choices. If we didn't educate or train ourselves, if we didn't choose a job field or profession that is needed in society, if we didn't take care of our health, if we didn't choose to exercise or maintain ourselves, as we say, boy, if I knew I was going to live this long, I'd have taken care of myself a little better. And we all laugh because we know how true it is. We know absolutely how true it is. Well, all you do is when you get older, a doctor will fix it. A drug company will invent a cure. We will demand the drug company give us the product that they have invented for a very cheap price because I have a right to have this service and treatment. We will require the government produce a program that will pay for it because we have a right to be well. We have a right to not be suffering. We have a right to have the opportunity to have all of the potential of the flesh. And on you could go and describe our entire society. I hear people all the time, even in the church, making statements about what our right ought to be in this society in terms of, well, they ought to do this for us, and they ought to do that for us, and they ought to give us this. What right do we have to demand those things of anyone else anyway? Did God give us such right? God gave us the right to suffer for the choices we make or to rejoice in the blessings we receive, and anything beyond that is an act of mercy. But it is not our right to somehow require that our crop not come in. Society wants to do an end run around that principle of God's creation. When the consequences of those things that we have chosen or subjected ourselves to or participated in come in, we feel cheated. And indeed, we simply have earned the results of the way God designed this creation. And I realize that that's not all on our each individual shoulders. Some of the things I did might be paid for by my grandson, and I'm sorry. And I have consequences of those things as well. We all do. Time and chance is a factor, but time and chance is not a factor that primarily determines how our lives play out. Ben mentioned a lotto winner or a lottery-type winner in his sermonette. That's one of the worst things in this world that could ever happen to anybody is to be enriched through luck because you haven't learned to use it, you didn't work productively to earn it, you haven't built up to it, you're not ready for it, and in most cases, it will destroy you. Most of the lottery winners, if you go back in 5 years, have less than they had before they won the lotto the first time in 5 years later, because they have destroyed themselves in the process. Good and bad happens to everyone. Luck is not a determining factor in most of us in the way that our lives play out. It is surely not a determining factor in our relationship to God. Some people have tough breaks. Tough breaks are not an excuse for failure. I remember years back in Spokesman's Club, two of the members that were in one of the particular clubs, which is one of the best that I had ever been in, one of the men had dyslexia and the other man had a speech impediment. And the speech impediment on the one man, when he would speak to you conversationally, he would stutter. And it was very hard for him to get the words out. And he would pray and prepare a speech, and he would stand up, and from the moment he began his speech, he would give an entire Spokesman's Club speech without a stutter or a stall, and the minute he was done, it was gone. And you could not talk to him without all the stutter and the struggle, but when he gave a Spokesman's Club speech, it flowed out clean from beginning to end. That was the only time I ever heard him speak clearly. He made it through club and he graduated. The individual that year that had the dyslexia couldn't read notes. He'd have to memorize a speech and give it from memory because he couldn't read his notes when they would jumble in front of his eyes. And he graduated from club and went through. They were successful. They were contributors to the church. They were respected. They were loved. We can't use tough breaks as an excuse for failure. That's still a choice. Everybody has a little different burden to carry, a blessing to exercise, a little different responsibility to implement. God, Deuteronomy 30, set before us in His creation and specifically in our service to Him a fundamental choice. Deuteronomy 30 and verse 19. I call heaven and earth as witnesses today against you that I have set before you life and death, blessing and cursing. Therefore, choose life that you and your descendants may live. God said in His law as He laid out and in His relationship as He called Israel to Him, and we've been called to relationship to God, God says, I'm setting out for you in a specific way life and death, blessing and cursing. You can actually choose blessing and choose not cursing. You can choose life and reject death. We have that choice. We have relationship to God. God has set this before us in a very specific spiritual way. And you know what? It is amazing how predictable life becomes when we understand this. It is incredible how predictable life becomes when we understand this principle and how God set this creation up and how He works with us as His children and His family. When we understand this, it actually gives us freedom. We're not in bondage to misconception. We're not in bondage to fearing things that don't exist. It gives us the freedom to understand that God gives us in our hands the right to choose. We are not driven by fate or luck or the political wanderings of our land or by wars or diseases or pestilence. We are not driven in those ways. I'm not saying we are not impacted, but those issues are not the fundamental driving force in our life. We are driven as God calls us by choice. Galatians 6, back to where I started, but opening it just a little more, in verse number 7. Do not be deceived. God is not mocked. Whatever a man sows, that he will also reap. For if he sows to his flesh, will the flesh reap corruption? But he who sows to the Spirit will of the Spirit reap everlasting life. And let us not grow weary while doing good. Let us recognize this process never stops. And don't ever get off the banquet or off the ship or off the train, because this process will go on and your decisions will go on and the fruit of those decisions will continue. Don't ever stop, for in due season we shall reap if we do not lose heart. I focused quite a bit today on the crops that come in that we wished wouldn't have. God says, if you do not lose heart, the crop's going to come in that you really indeed wish would. If you do not lose heart, in due season, we shall reap. We shall reap everlasting life.